Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Xfinity Mobile, featuring customized wireless plans. Customers can choose unlimited, buy the gig, shared data, or a mix of both and switch it up anytime. Learn more at xfinitymobile.com.
We begin this hour with 16-year-old Lydia Gustav Werthen. She talked to us about her long battle with anorexia nervosa, a disorder where people starve themselves and become severely malnourished. It took 5 hospitalizations before she beat the illness.
My name is Lydia. I am 16 years old. I go to the Harker School in San Jose. When I entered junior high, then I guess I was more aware of how there were a lot of skinny girls and they all had boyfriends. And so I stopped eating lunch. I started exercising more. I kept a food diary eventually. And I would calculate, like, how many calories, how many grams of fat were in each food, every item of food I ate. When I looked in the mirror, I saw an overweight girl. I lost a lot of hair. I skipped my period for about 2 years. My nails were very brittle. I was pale. I was just severely underweight, so I was put in the hospital for the first time when I was 13. My dad found out about it first. I was coming out of school and waiting for him to pick me up, and when we got in the car, he drove me straight to the hospital. I used to go on pro-anorexic sites. It used to be, like, one of the main things I did during the day when I was staying home and recovering, or supposedly recovering. I felt safe when I went on those sites. I felt like someone understood me, and I felt like someone else knew my secret. I was sent to a residential center. I was sent to a mental hospital. And then from there, I was sent to the eating disorder ward in the hospital in Berkeley. The psychiatrist there, he was straight to the point. He would say, like, Lydia, you are too skinny. You look terrible. And when you gain weight, you're going to look fabulous and everyone will love you. And I hated how honest he was, but at the same time, I loved it. It was so motivating for me to get better, and it was great. They would talk to you during your meals about how you felt about the meal. I would cut up my food into tiny pieces, and I remember they gradually took me through this process of slowly cutting my food into bigger pieces, into not having to cut it at all.
I was really nervous when we came home also, because I was transferring into a kind of partial hospitalization after that, where you'd have breakfast and lunch at the hospital, but you'd come home for dinner. And the first day, I didn't want to get out from my room. I kind of slowly walked down the stairs and said, you know, I don't really want to eat dinner. But so my dad just said, okay, well, sit down and talk to me. Just talk. Say anything you want. And I did not go back upstairs. I stayed downstairs for dinner. I ate everything on my plate. I feel so powerful that I've come to this point in my life. Like, if I'm having a hard time at school or thinking about a test, then I just remind myself, like, Lydia, if you conquered an eating disorder, you can do anything.
Lydia's story was produced by Shuka Kalantari. People with disorders like Lydia's can get help at Stanford University. We visited the campus recently to talk with 2 physicians who tackle the physical and mental health aspects of disordered eating. Dr. James Locke is the psychiatric director of the Comprehensive Eating Disorders Program at Stanford, and Dr. Seth Ammerman, he's with the Division of Adolescent Medicine at the Lucile Packard Children's Hospital at Stanford. I began by asking Dr. Locke to comment on that story we just heard about Lydia's struggle with anorexia and how common her symptoms were.
Lydia had anorexia nervosa, and in general, her story is really consistent with what we typically see. She's a person between 12 and 15 years old. Usually it's a girl. She begins to think about her appearance and her weight. She changes her behaviors, and in certain kinds of kids, they actually do exactly what she did. They get extreme about it. And most people can't get that extreme or be effective at being that extreme. She could.
And is it the kind of thing that happens over time? Is it gradual?
Actually, her story is a little unusual, and she talks about starting her concerns around age 6. Usually it happens a little more quickly than that. In fact, that's one of the problems. Symptoms can develop at beginning of school in seventh or eighth grade, and you can be very sick by the second semester of that same year. So there's a quick shift in weight and weight loss and behavior that takes everyone by surprise.
And is there a trigger for it?
There are lots of triggers. There are a lot of psychosocial triggers that people have identified. Maturation with puberty, social concerns around adolescence and appearance. The media presents images of attractive women being very thin, men being very fit and slim. So those are the kinds of triggers we typically think of, and kids will report them.
Now, Lydia's problem was anorexia, but there are other kinds of eating disorders, binge eating, bulimia, and so on. Of those three, which is the most common?
Binge eating in adolescence is not too common in its own form, where you're just binge eating. That usually onsets in young adulthood. You may have some binge behaviors earlier, but that's a bit later. It is probably the most common of the disorders in adulthood. In adolescence, bulimia nervosa usually onsets a little bit later, maybe 16, 17, anorexia about 13, 14. Bulimia is about twice the rate of anorexia, which is a little under 1%, and bulimia is 2 to 3%.
And just to describe the differences among those disorders, if you would.
Well, anorexia is a disorder where the preoccupation is around lower and lower weights, trying to maintain an extremely thin, unrealistically thin body, such that your physiologic needs and health needs are compromised. In bulimia, you have a pattern of wanting to lose weight for the purposes of appearance, but you aren't able or you don't continue to lose weight dramatically. Instead, you get starved and then you binge eat. And in that process, you overeat in a short period of time, feel out of control, feel terrible, and then you want to get rid of that. And you purge it either by vomiting or exercise or taking laxatives, that kind of thing.
Is one more serious or more difficult to treat than another?
Anorexia appears to be more physically serious and concerning. It is more difficult to treat as well. The determination of a person with anorexia is informed by a belief that they don't have a problem. We call it egocentric, meaning they actually think that we're all wrong. They're actually fat, and we're telling them they're thin, and they don't have a problem in their view. The bulimic person actually realizes that often they don't like these behaviors. They feel trapped by them. They want to have changed their appearance. They don't really like having to binge and purge to try and accomplish these aims. So there's more traction for change and motivation for change in the bulimics, and that makes them easier to treat on average.
Yeah. Dr. Ammon, anything you want to add?
You've been talking about specific names of eating disorders like anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa and binge eating disorder, but there's a large group of young people who may not meet the exact criteria for anorexia or bulimia, but engage in these same behaviors that Dr. Locke was talking about, and they can be equally dangerous and medically compromising. And
like what?
Well, for example, to be diagnosed specifically with anorexia nervosa, you have to have no period for 3 months in a row, and you have to lose a certain amount of body weight. And you have to say that you have a distorted body image, essentially. And patients may meet one or more of these criteria, but not all of them, so we can't actually diagnose them as anorexia. But the behaviors they're engaging in terms of trying to get to that extreme point that Dr. Locke was talking about can be equally dangerous in terms of the weight loss and malnutrition that lead to the medical complications that we see.
It seems that most people with eating disorders are women, but how common is it among boys and young men?
So in anorexia, it's 90% girls and about 10% boys, and in bulimia, it's probably about 15% boys. They are majority female illnesses. Actually, once a boy presents with an eating disorder, in terms of the behaviors, they're really similar.
And how do you distinguish between like a diagnosis, especially for, say, bulimia, versus an athlete, for example, a wrestler, a high school wrestler who knows that they need to lose a certain amount of weight to get into a certain wrestling class, a weight class, which seems more rational in a way.
Seeming rational is one thing and being rational is another, and it does in the minds of wrestlers. It's a good example. Wrestlers will have a very set of sometimes very destructive behaviors, not drinking, trying to dehydrate themselves to lower their weights, throwing up stuff and so forth. Also, they're a group at risk, as are gymnasts and a number of other athletes at risk, because their weight actually does affect their performance. Those behaviors, if they become habitual, that's going to lead to the disorder. They're dangerous anyway and shouldn't be done. And coaches should be looking out for that and should just like they would for steroid use or any other inappropriate way to manage developing the body that you need to be able to compete. This would fit into my mind that same category.
Dr. Immerman, there's a perception that many have that disorders like anorexia and bulimia are really most prevalent in middle-income, upper-middle-income families. Is that accurate?
No. Eating disorders really can affect every ethnic, racial, and socioeconomic group of people. We've in the hospital at the inpatient program at Packard Children's Hospital, we've had migrant farm workers' kids who are Latino. We've had African-American patients. So one of the things that I do is that I'm the medical director of a community outreach program sponsored by Packard Children's Hospital. It's a mobile medical clinic that targets uninsured and homeless youth. We remarkably see a lot of kids who have disordered eating in this population, which is low income and even homeless. A colleague of mine and I, Dr. Rebecca Peebles, we did a research project also with Dr. Locke. We surveyed over 100 kids in our mobile clinic program, about half of whom were homeless. And we found that those who were intensive internet users had much higher rates of disordered eating, abnormal behaviors such as binging and purging, using diet pills and using laxatives. And this is a population which is very underserved and disadvantaged.
And what's that connection between the internet and those behaviors?
That's a good question. We think that, in part, the kids who spend intensive time on the internet are looking for answers to questions about body image, specifically for the eating disorders, about their behaviors and body image. And this is, in one sense, often their only source of information. And a lot of the information on the internet is misinformation, as we know. Yep. One thing I do want to talk about and make sure we get to is just the medical complications, because these disorders can be extremely serious medically. Not only can patients die from malnutrition, but they can also have irreversible long-term medical consequences, including abnormal growth. Girls can become infertile. They can have abnormal bone density and end up having bones at the age of 15 or 20, like a 50 or 60-year-old woman. And some of these problems are irreversible if the disorder goes on long enough. So the medical consequences are quite severe. And when kids are hospitalized for these issues, they're often in shock because they've been out exercising and running around, and all of a sudden we have them stuck on a bed and on a cardiac monitor because we're worried about their heart failing.
What is the therapy, the kind of mental health therapy, psychotherapy that works?
For anorexia specifically, this has been a challenge. Just to put this in context, this is a disorder that was described 150 years ago in the medical literature. We have had in the world literature only in adolescence about 600 kids ever studied in treatments. About half of them have been studied here at Stanford, as it turns out. We've been using a treatment here and studying a treatment here where families are assisted in trying to help their child recover from anorexia nervosa. The families are not blamed or made responsible for the cause of the disorder. In fact, the opposite of the case. They're taught to actually manage the problems that the anorexia nervosa is presenting, the really severe dieting, the overexercise, the social withdrawal, all those processes the family is helped with a therapist to learn to manage. This has been shown to be, as far as I know, the only evidence-based treatment we have for anorexia nervosa. And it's really effective for patients who are found within the first 2 or 3 years of the onset of the illness, their adolescence generally. And after that, frankly, if you move to adulthood, we don't have any really good treatments for anorexia nervosa. Turning to bulimia for a moment, The best evidence treatment is cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a therapy which has been used for depression and anxiety and OCD, and it's been studied pretty well in adults with bulimia nervosa. Actually, we have only two studies ever in bulimia nervosa in adolescents that have been published in the world literature, 120 kids, even though the behaviors onset and the disorder onsets in this age period.
Let me just stop you. So cognitive behavioral therapy is helping people think about things in a different way.
Well, cognitive behavioral therapy is this. It's, first of all, helping people experiment with changing their behaviors and looking at the effects, and then changing their cognitions by challenging them in the context of behavioral change. So it's a graded kind of intervention where you're working with both changing binging and purging, people's dieting behavior, asking them to keep food records, think about what they've done, analyze how they've moved forward with that change, and then trying to gradually change that behavior over about a six-month period.
What advice would you have, Dr. Ammerman, for families, for parents and siblings and friends even, you know, to be on the lookout for some of the behaviors or some of the changes, you know, that are warning signs?
Well, I think parents, as in so many other adolescent issues that come up, just need to check in with their kids on a regular basis about how they're feeling about themselves, about how things are going with them. If parents are starting to notice changes in the kids' behavior, going on diets or seeming to overexercise or withdrawing socially, at first sign, parents should check in with the kids and really keep a tab on what's going on.
Dr. Locke, anything you'd add to that advice for parents and families?
Well, just a little more specific things about some warning signs that would get me worried and I'd want parents to think about. The first is if there is a radical shift in a developing kid's diet. Are they really saying, I'm not going to eat things I used to like, and they're really perseverant in it? Second, if you notice that they're going to websites to look at dieting materials, if your kid begins to go to, after they're eating, go take a shower, think about, why are they doing that? Well, they go there and they throw up in the shower. It's something to take note of. The hardest part is it can happen so quickly. You know, parents are really busy and kids are really busy and, you know, you're making sure they're getting to whatever they're doing and their school and everything. And you'll say, well, whoa, I didn't notice. And a grandparent or an aunt or uncle will come and say, wow, what happened to her? She looks like she's so scared. And the parents who are accustomed to seeing her every day do not see this. So you'll get some feedback from people sometimes at a sporting event who haven't seen your child for a while or a relative and says, what's happened there?
Well, gentlemen, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Physicians Jim Locke and Seth Ammerman from Stanford University. To hear a conversation between Lydia, the girl we heard at the beginning of this segment, and her father, go to our website. You can also see photos of the teen health van in action. That's at healthdialogues.org.